delight in our choices that we've made that lays the foundation for living a new way. And part of that delight comes from having some appreciation of our good ethics, of having a good ethical foundation in our lives. And it is not particularly moralistic, this attitude, but rather that when we are no longer involved with harming other people, no longer lying to people or stealing or harming people, from the day when we decide to do that, that commitment or that decision to do that, to whatever degree that commitment is, can be a source of delight, source of appreciation, of rejoicing. One of the words that Buddhism uses is to rejoice in your own good qualities that come from such a decision. And from that arises the possibility of joy. And joy is much more connected to meditation practice, but doesn't have to be. But to begin appreciating the small and large joys of our lives, so that those joys become a foundation that help us cultivate meditation practice, help us cultivate concentration. So after joy, the next kind of precondition, or some people call it prerequisite, some condition for further work of liberation, is tranquility and calmness, this word pasadi. And a lot of people, when they think about meditation, associate it with calmness and tranquility. And a lot of people are attracted to meditation practice because it's going to bring them some calmness and some tranquility. When I teach the introductory course in Palo Alto, I usually warn people, I say, look, the point of meditation practice, of insight meditation, is not to become calm, but rather to see clearly. And one of the reasons I say this is that there's a tremendous attachment people have to states of calm, to becoming tranquil. And often the attachment people have to calmness is in direct proportion to the degree to which they're agitated, and direct proportion to the degree to which their mind is filled with fire and clinging and tension, and their body is filled with such things. And so they're desperate to have some kind of relief from that kind of tension of the mind and the body. And they've heard, you know, that mindfulness practice is a great form of stress reduction. But if meditation practice is only being done for purposes of physical or mental stress reduction, you're not going to go very far in terms of the spiritual potential that the practice has to offer. And that's why I say that it's not enough just simply to focus on calm and relaxation, that there has to be some much more deeper seeing into the structures of our identity, the structures of our of the kind of self concepts that we hold on to, that we kind of base our personal existence on. There has to be some very, very deep penetrating insight into the deeper attachments of our life. It's possible to be free of worry and free of anxiety, free of fear, in a kind of conventional way. And a person might say that, oh, I'm calm today, but that person's mind is still operating out of some very deep attachments. They're calm and not worried because basically everything's going well that day. And, you know, the sun is out and they've had a nice nap and, you know, phones haven't rung that often or whatever it is. So, we've done some things maybe good to help bring some calmness, but it's a calmness that's often part of the conditions around us. And we don't see that there's still seeds or momentum or the potential within us of being attached. And maybe there's still attachment to certain things. There can certainly be attachment to calm and tranquility. I read once, I've never seen it again, but I saw in some book that in Buddhism it said that the last attachment is the attachment to tranquility. So if you really want to be free, the last thing you need to let go of is your attachment to tranquility. I think you need to let go of it before the last, hopefully before that. The Buddha talked about tranquility of the body and tranquility of the mind as being somewhat two different things. There's a couple of stories about tranquility or calmness. One is a famous one the famous Buddhist king Ashoka. Ashoka was the great Buddhist king of India, He's kind of held up as the paradigm of the wise Buddhist king and the way he ruled ancient India. He lived around somewhere between the year 2 and 300 BC. But before he became a great Buddhist king, he was an awful king. And he went around India. He was the first person to kind of unite in India. And he united it with the sword. He went around conquering many of the neighboring countries within India, the continent of India. And he was apparently quite vicious, and there was great battles and great carnage on the battlefield. And it's said that one day, after defeating an enemy in a vicious battle where there were many, many, many people killed on the battlefield, he walked across the battlefield, across all the carnage and the dead bodies and the weapons lying everywhere, maybe still bodies screaming, people hadn't quite died, maybe they're still screaming and moaning. And he was felt quite distressed by this. It had a big impact on him, the power of what he saw. And in the middle of him surveying all this, a Buddhist monk began walking across the field from one end to the other. It was like the path that he was on happened to be through that field. And he walked through all that carnage with a demeanor of calmness and tranquility that the king had never seen in anyone before. And it contrasted so greatly with his own agitation, his agitation of maybe remorse about all the death, maybe his agitation of seeing all the death, perhaps the agitation of all his ambition and his drive, which had brought him to that point. When you're a great conqueror like that, you probably live in a certain degree of fear, the agitation of his fear. And in contrast to his agitation, there was this a very, very serene and calm monk that was walking across the field. And that caught his attention. And he went over and talked to the monk. And the monk said this, I think I have with me. Attention is the path to the deathless. Inattentiveness is the path to death. The attentive die not. The inattentive are already dead. So, attention is pretty important. So, that again caught the king's attention, and he thereby became a Dharma king. He renounced war and violence, and became an advocate of nonviolence. And he abolished capital punishment in his kingdom. He abolished he set up all kinds of animal hospitals, people hospitals all over, and became known as this great righteous king of ancient India. But the impact that really changed him was the impact of meeting someone who's calm and serene. It said a similar story existed for the Buddha. He was quite agitated when he finally left the palace and encountered the real conditions of the world. And then he also saw not a Buddhist monk, but a renunciant who was also quite calm, and it got his attention. And I think in my own life also, I've met people in my early years of practice who there was a certain tranquility and calmness to who they were that showed me that it was possible to live in a different way than I was living at the time. And I was greatly inspired by the example of these people. The other story is another one of these R-rated Buddhist stories. The last one was R-rated, all the carnage. And this is a Zen story. Bodhidharma was the great Zen monk who brought Zen from India to China. And he was quite an austere teacher, apparently, and he sat in a cave by himself for a long time, meditating in China. And the person who was going to become his successor was a monk, Buddhist monk, who was quite agitated and hadn't felt he had much success in his years of practice. And was quite had a lot of didn't have any peace of mind. And he heard that there was a Zen master up in the mountains in this cave that who could help him, maybe. So he made his way up in the middle of the winter and stood in the snow outside the cave, and Bodhidharma would have nothing to do with him. And this is the, you know, maybe the hopefully the mythical R-rated version of the story. After some days of standing in the snow, Weka, which is cut off his right or one of his arms, and then presented it to Bodhidharma as proof of his sincerity, that he really wanted help, he really wanted to, he was sincere about practicing. And, well, that got Bodhidharma's attention. So, I think the story of him cutting off his arm is partly told to indicate the strength of the need. This man was really at odds with himself, really didn't have any peace, and was desperate for some different way of living. And he was so motivated that he would go to great extremes. I hope none of us go to those extremes, but I think sometimes it takes extending oneself further than our comfortable lives if one really wants to discover the full possibility of freedom. So finally, Bodhidharma said, "Well, what do you want?" And the guy said, "My mind is really agitated. I want peace of mind." And Bodhidharma said to him, "Show me your mind. Where's your mind that's so agitated? Show it to me." And Weka, at that moment, was awakened. And the way the story is often understood is that in being asked, you know, look for the very mind which is agitated, which is on fire. Look at the very mind which is suffering. In that turning the mirror back on the mind itself, he found the mind was not there, or was empty, or the mind was already tranquil, or the mind was transparent, or the mind had the quality of freedom already. Many of us are agitated because of the way we relate to the objects of the world, to the objects of what the mind can know. We're so preoccupied with what we know. And what we know, for example, is we know about our relationships, so we're agitated about relationships we're in. We know about work. We know about our bodies. We know about our security. We know all these things that fill the mind with knowing. But the mind itself, which is the container for that knowing, if you look for it, strange things begin happening if you look deeply for it. And this is what happened to Weka. He was liberated when he looked for his own mind. When he kept looking for at his problems, maybe there was no end to problems. But if he looked, somehow had the ability to look back into the mind, into the depths of the mind, then something very different happens. So I don't know how that story sits with you, but how do we develop tranquility or calmness or peace? One form of calmness, which should never be underestimated, is the calmness that comes from living an ethical life. I have done unethical things in my life in the past, and the consequence of that, I've gotten really agitated. Boy, oh boy. I couldn't believe it. And the agitation afterwards was simply not worth the fleeting pleasure that it seemed to have provided in those circumstances. But some calmness, not simply of not having anything that bad in their background, but some tranquility or some ease of mind, knowing that one is blameless. The idea of being blameless is a very important teaching in Buddhism. And the Buddha said that if you're blameless, it means you can go into any room and you know that you're blameless. You know that no one has any cause to criticize you. So the idea of being blameless, at least from this moment, being blameless. I'll tell you, you want to hear another story? This following of stories? And you probably know, many of you, the story of Angulimala, who another one of these, maybe this one's X-rated, R-rated stories. They're nice that they're R-rated because they make them in some ways very real. He was the mass murderer in the time of the Buddha, and he had killed 999 people in his quest to kill 1,000. And each person he killed, he added one of their fingers to his necklace. So he had this big necklace with 999 fingers. And he needed one more person. And it turned out an easy victim was his mother. Now the Buddha heard of, kind of in his psychic powers, found out that Angulimala was about to go kill his mother, which is really bad karma. So the Buddha said, oh, I'm going to go into the forest and take care of this situation. So Angulimala saw this Buddhist monk just walking in his forest, unarmed, unattended, all by himself. He said, oh, great. This is an easy victim. And he's, boy, talk about easy. I just need 1,000 people. And here he's just presenting himself. So he started going after the Buddha. And the Buddha just stayed calm. And just continued to calmly walk down the road. And Angulimala couldn't catch up to him. And the faster he ran, the calmer the Buddha walked, and the greater distance there was. Just, you know, Buddha was using his psychic powers and magic. And so he just couldn't catch up to, Angulimala just couldn't catch up to the Buddha. So finally, in frustration, the murderer said, hey you, stop. And the Buddha continued calmly, and he looked over his shoulder and said, I've already stopped. Why don't you stop? Now, that caught Angulimala's attention. And he understood he was dealing with someone who had something else in mind. And he understood that, and what the Buddha was saying was, I've already stopped my agitated mind. I've stopped, you know, I've found peace in my own mind. Why don't you stop also? Stop your agitated activity and search for revenge and whatever he was doing with his mass murdering. And so Angulimala then became a disciple of the Buddha. And he became a Buddhist monk and became fully awakened. He became one of the fully enlightened beings. But then the story continues, where one day the Buddha and Angulimala were walking through a village. And it might have been a village where Angulimala had killed some of his victims. But anyway, in any case, they were walking through this village, and there was a woman going through labor pains. And it was very difficult labor for her. And she was, I guess, making painful noises, probably yelling and screaming. They had very little help back then, right, in ancient India. So there's a belief in ancient India that a statement which is true, if stated almost as a kind of like a, it's called a truth statement, but it has certain magic powers. And if you say something which is really true, that somehow has an effect on the people around you and will produce beneficial results. So the Buddha told Angulimala, oh, you should make a truth statement to help this woman through her delivery. Go and tell her that I have never harmed anyone my whole life. And Angulimala looked at the Buddha and said, what? I can't say that. You know, I'm one of the most awful people around, what I did in my past. And then the Buddha said, okay, well, go say that from the day that I was ordained as a Buddhist monk, I have never harmed anyone. Yeah, I can say that. That's a true statement. So he went there into the house of the woman and said, since the day I was ordained, I have never harmed anyone. And then the baby was born. Maybe, you know, to meet someone who could be really honest like that or was enough to relax. Who knows? But the point being that he became blameless from the day he became ordained as a Buddhist monk. And there was certain power of that blamelessness that in this maybe mythic story translates into helping someone through labor. So I mean, a little bit unsettling story for some of us, the idea that someone could get away with 999 murders and then just become a Buddhist monk and get enlightened and that's it. There's quite a more to the story than that, but that's for another time. So there's the tranquility that can come from being blameless. There's a tranquility that comes from being concentrated. And this is what a lot of people associate meditation with. If you focus on your breathing, for most people, if you kind of can rest your attention on your breath, keep coming back to something very simple and mundane as your breathing, then the normal ways in which the mind is agitated, kind of monkey mind, is chasing many different concerns and preoccupations and fears or whatever, it begins to quiet down. The mind can't do too many things, so if you have the mind finally resting on one thing, kind of saying, stay here, you know, stay put, then it begins to quiet down. Jack Kornfield likes to liken this to training a puppy. You've probably heard him talk about that. And the puppy keeps running away, and you don't scream and yell and beat your puppy. You kind of very kindly say, you know, come back here, come back here. And slowly the puppy begins to calm down, slowly, I guess, learns to sit and to be toilet trained or whatever the analogy is. So concentration is very important for tranquility. But more important for us who are doing mindfulness practice is the ability for us to see directly our agitated mind, or at least our agitation. One of the very important principles of mindfulness is that we don't chase after the ideal way of being as much as we try to understand and pursue what keeps us from the ideal. If we want to be loving, we don't try to make ourselves loving. We try to understand what stands in the way of our loving. If we want to be compassionate, what stands in the way of being compassionate? If we want to be fearless, understand your fear really well. If you want to have confidence, understand your fear really well, your doubts. And if you want to be calm, understand your agitation really well. Understand the forces of agitation within you. Understand what it is that triggers you to start worrying or being afraid or whatever. And then in seeing it clearly, knowing it, see if you can discover a new relationship to it. How can you relate to that agitation so you're not continuing to feed it and fuel it, but rather so that maybe you give it lots of space and acceptance so it can begin to unwind by itself. The tremendous power of open awareness, simply open awareness, generous awareness, compassionate awareness of what's actually here, begins to unravel some of the very things that stand in the way of the ideal. So to see very clearly into the nature of what actually makes us tick is a very, very important part of mindfulness practice. It's not something which people would many people would rather that their spiritual practice didn't involve that, because it's not very spiritual, is it, to kind of look at your fear or your agitation or your ambition or your hatred or your lust or your aversions or your confusions or whatever it is that's kind of perpetuating your agitation. You'd rather say, well, I do this great meditation on infinite love. I mean, or I do some great meditation on infinite light, or that's really, you know, spiritual. But this stuff of looking at my fear, I mean, what's that? But this is the way it works in Buddhism, that to really be honest and see directly is very helpful. There's, of course, a wonderful interplay between the calm that we develop from concentration and our ability to see honestly what's going on in our minds. The more calm we are, the easier it is to see clearly. And then the easier it is to see clearly, the calmer we get. One of the great analogies of developing calmness is that of the pond, the agitated pond. And you probably all know this, you know, if you now probably talked about it enough times, but the analogy is that if the pond, you have a muddy pond, if you take a stick into that muddy pond and stir it up, it'll never settle and become clear. But if you leave the pond alone and don't stir it up, with time all the mud and silt in the pond will settle into the bottom and you'll have a crystal clear pond. The teaching here is that there's something very powerful to be said about seeing clearly what's going on within us and not agitating it, not stirring it up anymore, not judging it or criticizing it or trying to fix it, but simply to hold it in open awareness. Hold it in open awareness. Hold it in open awareness. Hold it. Let it be held there. And then so many things in our life by themselves will begin to settle. Not only that, but the very holding itself is a movement of tranquility, of calmness. We meet our agitation with some modicum of calmness, calm seeing, allowing it to be there. And that calmness then begins to let the pond of the mind settle. Tranquility is never an end in itself for Buddhist practice, but rather is a stepping stone so that we can see ever more deeply. It's very hard to seek deeply, clearly, if we're agitated. One of the wonderful things, examples of this, perhaps, is when the mind is tranquil and calm, the most mundane things in life can seem spectacular, can seem to be awesome, miraculous, mysterious. When the mind is tranquil, you can leave a meditation session or leave wherever you are and go outside, and you can look at a leaf of a tree and be blown away. Wow! When you're agitated, you probably won't even notice there's any trees out there. You can walk out here and you can notice the most simple, mundane thing in the world. Some, you know, discarded candy wrapper on the pavement outside. And you can leave with enough calm and tranquility and peace of mind, that candy wrapper on the pavement can be one of the most beautiful things the world has ever created. Isn't that amazing? Have you ever had that experience that way? I hope so, some of you. I mean, otherwise you think I'm crazy. You don't have... Those of you who haven't had that experience think I'm talking about something crazy here. You know, why bother with a candy wrapper? I don't know why you bother with a candy wrapper. It's just you go out and it just like blows you away. Wow. So there's something that happens very special about when the mind is tranquil that allows it to appreciate the details of our present moment life, what's going on in the present moment. If we're agitated, the chances are agitation is about something in the past and something in the future. And so it's very hard then to appreciate what's going on in the present moment. But in order to develop a deeper insight of practice, we need to have the kind of interest in the present moment where even a candy wrapper on the pavement blows you away. It's fascinating. Because you have to be able to meet the details of your own mind, of your own heart, your own feelings, your emotions, your thoughts, your reactions, your fears. You have to meet them with the same kind of, be willing and interested to meet them in the present moment as they occur in the present moment. You have to be interested in your each inhalation and each exhalation as if it's like one of the most amazing things in the world. Enough so that you'll be willing and interested to stay present in the present moment. If you're not interested, if you're not interested in the present moment, it's going to be all too easy for you to flip off into thinking about the past or thinking about the future. But the work of liberation requires us to stay in the present moment, because the present moment is a stepping stone to being free. Not to say that thinking about the past and thinking about the future should never be done, but for the deeper work of liberation, you have to stabilize yourself in the present moment. You have to be willing to stay in the present. There's no freedom without being in the present. Freedom has to do about something that occurs in the present moment. As some people will sometimes say, will describe freedom as being an experience of timelessness. And timelessness only exists in the present, the timeless present. So from our joy, joy is a condition, a prerequisite for the possibility of tranquility and calmness. And one of the ways that works is that when our joy, especially in meditation practice, when our joy has lived itself out, when the energy of joy in its own natural way has dissipated, what gets left is experience of tranquility. And many people will find that tranquility that follows joy, meditative joy, is so much more sublime, so much more pleasurable, so much more delightful than joy is, or bliss. rapture. And it can be very hard to people who have never really had a lot of intense meditative joy, when it first occurs, they think they're enlightened. This is like the best. Wow. And then they get stronger, and this is even better. And then at some point you realize that it calms itself or relaxes, and you enter into this next stage of tranquility and calmness. Wow. I don't think I want that kind of joy anymore. I know something better now. But then you can get very agitated about that. And which I did, for example, on one long retreat I sat, where I knew I had the experience that there was something better than deep joy, that very intense joy and meditative joy. So I could feel at one point in my meditation that joy beginning to rise, because it kind of naturally comes. As you meditate at a certain point, joy will often just come on its own. So I started feeling it coming on. And I always said, uh-oh, I can't have this. I know something better than this, a deeper state of concentration. So I'll resist it. You know, I'll hold it back. And I remember doing walking meditation back and forth and back and forth, saying, I'm not going to feel that joy, no way. And I just got a headache. And finally, I just let go of my resistance to the joy, and the joy welled up inside of me because I was no longer holding it at a distance. Lo and behold, once I kind of, I spent, you know, maybe half an hour resisting it, and once I kind of opened to it and allowed it to come, it came, it peaked, and it passed within a minute or so. And then I found myself in that deeper place of tranquility. So I created all this agitation because I had this attachment to tranquility and aversion to something which I thought was coarser. So, tranquility, calmness, serenity. One of the traps of all this is to try to hold yourself in a state of being calm, to try to force yourself to be calm when you're not. Or if you have some modicum of calm, or any kind of calm, and then try to not maneuver carefully, kind of get through life, you know, without trying to hold on to it for all dear life. That doesn't work either. Part of part of the flexibility of practice, the flexibility is required of us as we practice, is a willingness to allow our mind and heart to flow as the conditions within us and around us change. And if we're getting more agitated, then allow that to happen without trying to hold on in a form of attachment or resistance to it happening, but rather use your mindfulness to follow along and be present for what's happening. Let the mindfulness lead, or let the mindfulness kind of hold everything. Don't try to resist or to stay attached to any particular states of mind. However, it is useful to appreciate tranquility and calmness, and to do maybe simple things in your daily life that can help foster it. Avoid doing things in an agitated way if you can, doing too many things at once. Doing one thing at a time is one of the great spiritual practices, unfortunately. Those of us who want to get more done. Give yourself sacred time. The old tradition, current tradition, some places of the Sabbath, was a period of sacred time where people allowed themselves to pause and experience something different. The sacred pause, the sacred presence, that's very different from the normal agitated, active life. But appreciate calmness. One of the last thing I'll say now, one of the themes in Buddhism is that your awareness and appreciation of wholesome states of mind, of beautiful states of mind, strengthens them. And your awareness of unwholesome states of mind weakens the unwholesome states of mind. It's a beautiful thing. All you have to do is continue to be mindful of whatever is happening. And the mindfulness itself, just by being mindful in a matter-of-fact way, will naturally weaken the unhealthy states of mind that arise and will strengthen the healthy ones. So appreciate your tranquility and calmness. Foster it to some degree, but in no way be attached to it. No way hold on to it. Let it come and go. So that's my talk on tranquility. Do you guys have any questions or comments you'd like to make? We have a couple of minutes. Yes, Cheryl.
When it comes to dealing with unwholesome thoughts, I think remember there's four ways that we were taught to help you sort of deal with it. And I can remember, I know one is substitution.
Oh, all that.
And then another is, I know the last one is just downright willpower, just stop thinking it.
Yeah, grit your teeth. I don't know if I remember them so well because I don't practice so much in that with that list. But the list is something like think about something else. The grit your teeth means like really say no to it. Sometimes it's very wise when we have kind of obsessive thought patterns that keep appearing over and over and over again, and you try to be mindful of it, and it just keeps coming back. And sometimes you just need to say just no to it. Enough of that. And so in mindfulness, maybe we get the impression that the practice is only about being aware of what goes on. You're never supposed to say no to anything. But occasionally, when things are just so obsessive, it's like a little child, sometimes you have to say no. Say no to them. No, stop that, you mind. And then it'll quiet down. Substitution. I'm sorry, I don't remember. Yes?
Do you have any criteria for
I took ibuprofen this morning because my back went out this morning, and so I took the ibuprofen because it's I thought maybe it would reduce any inflammation that might be starting up and make it a little bit easier for me. So that was my criteria this morning. And I wondered about it sitting here because I'm in a little bit of pain because of my back. And, it was wise for me to keep sitting here. And then I thought, well, you know, especially when I was sitting here, I was in silence, wondering, well, and once I start talking, I might not pay attention to my back so much anymore. And I might maybe the 45 minute talk just will make it worse. So there's a big question, you know, I had to watch very carefully, you know, how am I going to sit here with my back pain? Is it wise for me, should I go get a chair and sit in the chair? Is it wise for me to sit here this way? And there was a period when I first sat down, I actually wasn't sure. But I've had a lot of experience in the past of sitting with back pain, where sitting is one of the best things I can do for it. For me, my particular kind of back pain that I've had. So that gave me some confidence. Since I'm not quite sure what to do, let me at least, you know, I'm not damaging it anymore at least, but let's see what happens. Let's try sitting with it and being careful with my posture and sitting with the pain, being present for the pain as it's there and see how it goes. And once in the course of the sitting, I made a little correction in my posture because it didn't feel like it was working so well for my pain. My back looked like maybe it was going to hurt it more. And that seemed to help again. But it took me really investigating really carefully. Basically, the whole half hour, I was just riding that pain in my back. And I felt like I needed to ride it. I needed to really be present for it, because if I wasn't, then I could have hurt myself more. I think that if I hadn't been able to stay really present for the pain, I wouldn't have been good to have sat this way. I should have gotten up and gotten a chair, or gone home and lay down or something. So I don't know if this little personal example answers your question, but we sit with pain when we think that it's not going to damage us. And if you think it's going to be damaging, then by all means make some adjustment, a change. But if it's not going to damage you, it's a great way of developing concentration and insight. And a lot of understanding can arise out of sitting with pain. one of the great teachers. If you find that your pain is agitating you, and so the mind gets more and more increasingly agitated because of it, then perhaps it's the time to do something different, because increasing agitation is not helpful either. It's really, you know, it's powerful, very powerful and useful to sit with pain. Is this okay? If enough people request it at some point, some Sunday, I'm quite happy to give a talk just on pain. Yeah, whole day on pain. I gave a talk on pain a few years ago, and some people. I think it's in a tape library. You can check it out from Allison. But I'm happy. Should I give one at some point when I finish this series? Okay, we'll talk about pain someday, next couple of months. Nancy.
The story is told about Bodhidharma and the student cutting off his arm to make contact.
With the teacher.
That's the same man, Bodhidharma, who cut his eyelids off because it kept falling asleep while meditating.
That's the story.
Why do they have such eyelid examples?
Well, we don't. We're not in the Zen tradition. We just borrow those stories sometimes. Well, if we take it as pure myth, then we can interpret it kind of more as kind of psychologically, that if you're really serious about your spirituality, it really requires a lot of you, and you really have to be willing to sacrifice a lot, or really put a lot of yourself into the fire, or give up a lot in order to do it. So cutting off your arm symbolically means you have to really be willing to give up a lot in order to be free. And actually, in Zen tradition, sometimes they say you have to be willing to die, give up your life, and you know, it's not just simply your arm. And the Zen teachers in Japan will yell during sesshin in the zendo, they'll yell, you know, sit until you die, just die, you know. So, you know, psychologically, the kind of, you know, that's one way of seeing it, what the process is. And otherwise, why do they have, you know, maybe this kind of a macho tradition. You know, so maybe that's part of it. I mean, they go around with swords and whack each other on the shoulders in the old way. Well, it's complicated. I mean, certainly there's an element of truth that there is a thread in Zen of machoism, and it can be, you know, depending on the individual carrying the sword, sadism. I've heard horrible stories of people, you know, there's a sword is used to keep people awake in a Zen monastery, and they come and when people are sleeping in meditation, you come stand behind them with this big wooden sword. And you just kind of whack their shoulders. And if you're skilled, knowing what you're doing, it doesn't hurt. It's actually quite invigorating. And when I was a Zen monk, I used to ask for it to happen. Many people did. I mean, I wasn't unusual. And really appreciated it. But if someone is not skilled, and if it's a really heavy wooden sword, it can be quite... I've heard stories in Japan, never in America, stories in Japan of people being damaged from being struck. But that's whenever they talk about those examples, they're talking about some particular monk who was really a sadist, and would just use that as a... There was nothing inherent in Zen that requires of it, just that they were holding a sword, so great, you know, just get my stuff out. I don't know if I'm being very useful in my response to your answer. The part of Zen training is... and Zen practice, and Zen kind of way of being in the world, is to be very energetic, totally engaged in what you do, and kind of throw yourself into something and lose yourself in the activity itself. don't hesitate to think about what you're doing before you do it, just do it. And the idea of thinking about something is in Zen sometimes they say gets in your way of the actual doing. So there tends to be in Zen then a strong emphasis on this vigorous spontaneity. I take the stories, the ancient stories from China, as being mostly myth. The story of him cutting off his eyebrow I take as pure myth. And the myth continues, of course, in that Bodhidharma was the one who brought the tea plant from India to China. And when he threw down his eye, or I don't know if he brought it, but anyway, the myth is that when he threw down his eyebrow, his eyelids, onto the ground, the first tea plants sprouted from them. And it's wonderful because the Zen monks used to like to drink this black tea to keep them awake. So Bodhidharma gave up his eyelids to stay awake so that we could stay awake by drinking caffeinated tea. Also in the Zen tradition you have examples of Zen teachers using a very vigorous action to push the student over the edge into freedom. That a teacher who's really sharp can see when a well-practiced student is right on the edge, when there's very little attachment left, they're really concentrated, really present, really kind of coursing along really deeply in their practice, and all they need is a little push to let go of the last thing they have to let go of, to really fall into freedom. And so sometimes that push can be just slamming the door on the student, just a big loud bang. Or sometimes a teacher will come and yell. There's examples of teachers who will see some particular students in the meditation hall as really being ripe, and they'll come and stand behind the teacher and just give out this huge yell. And rather than frightening the student, they just like, you know, they just let go of the last thing that they're holding on to, and they just break out into uproarious laughter. And suddenly, what a joke it's all is. So that kind of, because in the Zen tradition, that kind of, that technique of a teacher using some really sharp action to push a student over, perhaps also lends to the sense that the tradition is has this kind of a little bit violent side to it. The Zen tradition association with the samurai culture of Japan, which it did have some association with it, lends it to itself also. The Zen tradition's association with not just Zen, but all of Japanese Buddhism, association with World War II and the military government. Most Japanese Buddhist religious groups actively supported with great doctrinal essays the Japanese war effort. And so there is this element in Zen that you're pointing to. And American Zen Buddhists have had to contend with this, this legacy and this kind of the momentum of that. And I think you see I don't know if you see it well enough, but I see it because I've been at the San Francisco Zen Center for so many years. I've seen over the last 25 years, I call it maturing, a mellowing of all that, a rejection of a lot of that. In the San Francisco Zen Center now, I believe they no longer use the stick, the sword, at all. For a while, they stopped using it. They only used it if you requested it. And so no one was struck. When I first got there, you were just struck, you know. You didn't know when you were going to be struck. You were sitting there, and they came over, and bang, oh, that's interesting. But then they stopped doing it, and they only did it on request. And then after a while, they only did it, and now they stopped doing it entirely. And there's a lot of the kind of more things that kind of felt more aggressive that came with the importation of Japanese Zen have been dropped. And I think it's a maturation and a wisdom. And you're finding a much friendlier environment and warmer and more compassionate environment than you did 25 years ago. I think that'll continue. The Zen Center in San Francisco now chants the Metta Sutta, which is not in the Zen tradition at all. But the loving, now they chant the Buddhist discourse on loving kindness. No, that's the refuges, which is also Pali, which is from this tradition. But don't they chant the Metta Sutta? this is what is done by a person who's skilled and wise. And it goes on like that. May all beings be happy, may all beings be free. Just as a mother with her only child, just as a mother protects her only child, so consider all beings with loving kindness. Something like that. So Zen is a great tradition. I don't want to knock it here. But there is this legacy that you're pointing to, which people have to grapple with. And you might ask your Zen teachers up there the same question. You know. So we should probably stop, so that you don't have to rush and get agitated. Get somewhere next. Thank you all, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.